if I had been holding in a gasp. "Is that you, Denzel?" I said, trying to sound normal. "Claire!" He burst through the door in relief, promptly tripped over something, and fell headlong with a rush.
"Welcome back, friend Hunter," Jamie said, the nervous urge to laugh evident in his voice. "Are you hurt?"
The long shadow detached itself from the wall and bent to help our visitor up.
"No, no, I don't think so. Though, in fact, I scarcely know. James, I did it."
There was a momentary silence.
"How close are Harwich?" Jamie asked quietly. "And do they move?"
"No, thank the Lord."
Denzel sat down abruptly beside me, and I could feel his trembling.
"They're waiting for their wagons to come up. They daren't outrun their supply line too far, and they're having terrible trouble. We've made such a mess of the roads."
The pride in his voice was palpable.
"And the rain's helped a great deal, too."
"Do you ken how long it might be?"
I saw Denzel nod, eager.
"One of the sergeants said it might be 2, even 3 days. He was telling some of the soldiers to be mindful of their flour and beer, as they wouldn't get any more until the wagons came."
Jamie exhaled, and I felt some of the tension leave him. Mine did too, and I felt a passionate wave of thankfulness. There would be time to sleep. I had just begun to relax a little. Now the tension flowed out of me like water to such an extent that I barely noticed what else Denzel had to confide. I heard Jamie's voice murmuring congratulations. He clapped Denzel on the shoulder and slid out of the barn, no doubt to go pass on the information. Denzel sat still, breathing audibly. I gathered what was left of my concentration and made an effort to be amiable.
"Did they feed you, Denzel?"
"Oh."
Denzel's voice changed and he began to fumble in his pocket.
"Here, I brought this away for thee."
He pushed something into my hands, a small squashed loaf, rather burnt about the edges. I could tell from the hard crust and the smell of ashes. My mouth began to water uncontrollably.
"Oh, no," I managed to say, trying to give it back. "You should..." "They fed me," he assured me. "Stew, of a sort. I ate all I could. And I've another loaf in my pocket for my sister. They gave me the food," he assured me earnestly. "I didn't steal it."
"Thank you," I managed to say, and with the greatest self-control tore the loaf in half and tucked one half in my pocket for Jamie. Then I crammed the remainder in my mouth and ripped at it like a wolf wrenching bloody mouthfuls from a carcass. Denny's stomach echoed mine, rumbling with a series of great borborygmi. "I thought you said you ate," I said, accusing.
"I did, but the stew seems not to incline to lie quiet," he said, with a small pained laugh.
He bent forward, arms folded over his stomach.
Don't suppose that thee might have a bit of barley water or peppermint to hand, friend Claire?"
"I do," I said, unspeakably relieved that I still had the remnants in my sack. I hadn't much left, but I did have peppermint. There was no hot water. I gave him a handful to chew, washed down with water from a canteen. He drank thirstily, burped, then stopped, breathing in a way that told me just what was happening. I guided him hastily to the side and held his head while he vomited, losing peppermint and stew together. "Food poisoning?" I asked, trying to feel his forehead. But he slid away from me, collapsing onto a heap of straw, his head on his knees.
"He said he'd hang me," he whispered suddenly.
"Who?"
"The English officer. A Captain Bradbury, I think his name was. Said he thought I was a playin' at spies and soldiers, and that if I didn't confess at once, he'd hang me."
"But he didn't," I said softly, and put a hand on his arm. He was trembling all over, and I saw a drop of sweat hanging from the tip of his chin, translucent in the dimness.
"I told him he could, I supposed, if he pleased.
And I truly thought he would. But he didn't. His breath came quick, and I realized that he was crying silently. I put my arms around him, held him, making hushing noises, and after a little he stopped. He was quiet for a few minutes.
I thought I would be prepared to die, he said softly, that I would go happy to the Lord whenever he chose to call me. I am ashamed to find it untrue. I was so much afraid.
I took a long, deep breath and sat back beside him. I always wondered about martyrs, I said. No one ever said they weren't afraid. It's only that they were willing to go and do whatever they did in spite of it. You went.
I did not set up to be a martyr, he said after a moment.
He sounded so meek I nearly laughed. I doubt very much that many people do, I said, and I think a person who did would be very obnoxious indeed.
It's late, Denzel, and your sister will be worried.
And hungry. It was an hour or more before Jamie came back. I was lying in the hay, my shawl pulled over me, but wasn't asleep. He crawled in beside me and lay down, sighing, putting an arm over me.
Why him? I asked after a moment, trying to keep my voice calm. It didn't work. Jamie was acutely sensitive to tones of voice, anyone's, but particularly mine. I saw his head turn sharply toward me, but he paused a moment in turn before answering.
He wished to go, he said,
doing much better with the approximation of calmness than I had. And I thought he'd do well with it.
Do well? He's no actor. You know he can't lie. He must have been stammering and tripping over his tongue. I'm astonished that they believed him. If they did, I added.
Oh, they did, aye. Do you think a real deserter wouldn't be terrified, Sassenach?
He said, sounding faintly amused.
I meant him to go in sweating and stammering. Had I tried to give him lines to speak, they'd have shot him on the spot.
The thought of it made the bolus of bread rise in my throat. I forced it back down. Yes, I said, and took a few breaths, feeling cold sweat prickle over my own face, seeing little Denny Hunter sweating and stammering before the cold eyes of a British officer.
Yes, I said again, but couldn't someone else have done it? It's not just that Denny Hunter is a friend. He's a doctor. He's needed.
Jamie's head turned toward me again. The sky outside was beginning to lighten. I could see the outline of his face.
Did you not hear me say he wished to do it, Sassenach? He asked. I didn't ask him. In fact, I tried to dissuade him for the very reason you said. But he wouldn't hear it, and only asked me to look after his sister, should he not come back.
Rachel. My stomach clenched afresh at mention of her.
What can he have been thinking? Jamie sighed deeply and turned onto his back.
He's a Quaker, Sassenach, but he's a man. If he was a sort of man who'd not fight for what he believes, he'd have stayed in his wee village and poulticed horses and looked after his sister. But he's not.
He shook his head and looked at me.
Would you have had me stay at home, Sassenach? Turn back from the fight?
I would, I said, agitation fading into crossness, in a heartbeat. I just know you aren't bloody going to, so what's the point? That made him laugh.
So you do understand, he said, and took my hand. It's the same for Denzel Hunter, aye? If he's bound to risk his life, then it's my job to see he gets the most return from his gambling.
Bearing in mind that the return of most gambling is a big fat zero, I remarked, trying to repossess the hand. Hasn't anyone ever told you that the house always wins? He wasn't letting go, but had begun to run the ball of his thumb gently back and forth over the tips of my fingers.
Aye, well, you reckon the odds and cut the cards, Sassenach.
And it's not all luck, Ken.
The light had grown in that imperceptible pre-dawn way. Nothing so blatant as a sunbeam. Just a gradual emergence of objects as the shadows round them went from black to grey to blue. His thumb slipped inside my hand, and I curled my fingers involuntarily over it. "Why isn't there a word that means the opposite of fade?" I asked, watching the lines of his face emerge from night's shadow. I traced the shape of one rough brow with my thumb, and felt the springy mat of his short beard against the palm of my hand, changing as I watched it, from amorphous smudge to a distinction of tiny curls and wiry springs, a glowing mass of auburn, gold and silver, vigorous against his weathered skin.
"But then I suppose you need one," he said, "if you mean the light."
He looked at me and smiled as I saw his eyes trace the outlines of my face.
"If the light is fading, the night's coming on. And when the light grows again, it's the night that's fading, aye?"
It was, too. We should sleep, but the army would be astir around us shortly. Why is it that women don't make war, I wonder?
You're no made for it, Sassenach.
His hand cupped my cheek, hard and rough.
And it wouldn't be right. You women take so much more wi' you when you go.
What do you mean by that? He made the small shrugging movement that meant he was looking for a word or a notion, an unconscious movement as though his coat was too tight, though he wasn't wearing one at the moment.
"When a man dies, it's only him," he said,
"and one is much like another.
Aye, a family needs a man to feed them, protect them, but any decent man can do it. A woman."
His lips moved against my fingertips, a faint smile.
"A woman takes life with her when she goes. A woman is infinite possibility."
"Idiot," I said very softly, "if you think one man is just like any other."
We lay for a bit, watching the light grow.
"How many times have you done it, Sassenach?" he asked suddenly, "sat between the dark and the dawn, and held a man's fear in the palms of your hands?"
"Too many," I said, but it wasn't the truth, and he knew it. I heard his breath come, the faintest sound of humour, and he turned my hand palm up, his big thumb tracing the hills and valleys, joints and calluses, lifeline and heartline, and the smooth, fleshy swell of the Mount of Venus where the faint scar of the letter J was still barely visible. I'd held him in my hand for the best part of my life.
"Part of the job," I said, meaning no flippancy.
And he didn't take it that way.
"Do you think I'm not afraid?" he asked quietly, "when I do my job."
"Oh, you're afraid," I said. "But you do it anyway. You're a frigging gambler. And the biggest gamble of all is a life, isn't it? Maybe yours, maybe someone else's."
"I will," he said softly. "You'd know about that, I suppose." "I'm the less bothered for myself," he said thoughtfully. "Looking at it all in all, I mean. I've done the odd useful thing here and there. My children are grown. My grandchildren are thriving. That's the most important thing, no?"
"It is," I said. The sun was up. I heard a rooster crow somewhere in the distance.
"Well, so. I can't say I'm so very much afraid as I used to be. I shouldn't have liked dying, of course. But there'd maybe be less regret in it. On the other hand..."
One side of his mouth turned up as he looked at me.
"While I may be less afraid for myself, I'm that wee bit more reluctant to kill young men who've not yet lived their lives."
And that, I thought, was as close as I'd get to an apology for Denny Hunter.
"Going to assess the age of the people shooting at you, are you?" I asked, sitting up and beginning to brush hay out of my hair.
"Difficult," he admitted.
"And I sincerely hope that you don't propose to let some whippersnapper kill you, merely because they haven't had such a full life as yours yet."
He sat up too and faced me, serious.
ends of hay bristling from hair and clothes.
No, he said, I'll kill them. I'll just mind it more.
Chapter 58. Independence Day. Philadelphia, July the 4th, 1777. Gray had never been to Philadelphia before. Bar the streets, which were execrable, it seemed a pleasant city. Summer had graced the city's trees with huge, verdant crowns, and a walk left him lightly dusted with leaf fragments and the soles of his boots sticky with fallen sap. Perhaps it was the febrile temperature of the air that was responsible for Henry's apparent state of mind, he thought darkly. Not that he blamed his nephew. Mrs. Woodcock was lissome but rounded, with a lovely face and a warm character. And she had nursed him away from death's door when the local prison officer had brought him to her, worried lest a potentially lucrative prisoner die before yielding a full harvest. That sort of thing formed a bond, he knew, though he had never, thank God, felt any sort of tendresse for any of the women who had attended him in ill health. Except for... shit, he said involuntarily, causing a clerical-looking gentleman to glare at him in passing. He had clapped a mental teacup over the thought that had buzzed through his head like a meddlesome fly. Unable not to look at it, though, he cautiously lifted the cup and found Claire Fraser under it. He relaxed a little. Certainly not a tendresse. On the other hand, he was damned if he could have said what it had been. A most peculiar sort of unsettling intimacy, at least. No doubt the result of her being Jamie Fraser's wife, and her knowing what his own feelings for Jamie were. He dismissed Claire Fraser and went back to worrying about his nephew. Pleasant Mrs. Woodcock undeniably was, and just as undeniably rather too fond of Henry for a married woman, though her husband was a rebel, Henry had told him, and God knew when or whether he might return. Well enough, there was no danger of Henry losing his head and marrying her, at least. He could imagine the scandal, should Henry bring home a carpenter's widow, and she a sable enchantress to boot. He grinned at the thought, and felt more charitable toward Mercy Woodcock. She had, after all, saved Henry's life. For now. The unwelcome thought buzzed in before he could clap the teacup over it. He couldn't avoid it for long. It kept coming back. He understood Henry's reluctance to undergo another surgery, and there was the lingering fear that he might be too weak to withstand it. But at the same time, he couldn't be allowed to remain in his present state. He would simply dwindle and die, once illness and pain had drained the last of his vitality. Not even the fleshly attractions of Mrs. Woodcock would hold him, once that happened. No, the surgery must be done, and soon. In Gray's conversations with Dr. Franklin, the old gentleman had made him acquainted with a friend, Dr. Benjamin Rush, who, he claimed, was a most prodigious medical man. Dr. Franklin urged Gray to visit him should he ever find himself in the city, had given Gray a letter of introduction, in fact. He was on his way to present this, in hopes that Dr. Rush might either be practiced in surgery or be able to refer him to someone who was. Because, whether Henry wanted it or not, it had to be done. Gray could not take Henry home to England in his present state, and he had promised both Minnie and his brother that he would bring their youngest son back, were he still alive. His foot slipped on a muddy cobble, and he let out a whoop and pitched sideways, arms pinwheeling for balance. He caught himself and shook his clothes back into order with a good assumption of dignity, ignoring the giggles of two milkmaids who had been watching. Damn it all, she was back. Claire Fraser. Why? Of course. The ether, as she'd called it. She'd asked him for a carboy of some sort of acid, and had told him that she required it to make ether. Not as in the ethereal realm, but a chemical substance that rendered people unconscious so as to make surgery painless. He stopped dead in the middle of the street. Jamie had told him about his wife's experiments with the substance, with a full account of the amazing operation she had performed on a young boy. He, rendered completely senseless as she opened his abdomen, removed an offending organ, and sewed him back together. After which the child was right as a grig, apparently. He walked on more slowly, thinking furiously. Would she come? It was a laborious journey to almost anywhere from Fraser's Ridge. Not such a terrible trip from the mountain to the shore, though. It was summer. The weather was good. The journey could be made in less than 2 weeks. And if she would come to Wilmington, he could arrange for her to be brought to Philadelphia on whatever naval vessel was available. He knew people in the Navy. How long? How long might it take her, if she would come? More sobering thought, how long did Henry have? He was pulled from these troubling reflections by what appeared to be a small riot proceeding down the street in his direction. A number of people, most of them drunken to judge by their behaviour, which involved a good deal of shouting and pushing and waving of handkerchiefs. A young man was beating a drum with much enthusiasm and no skill, and two children bore between them an outlandish banner striped red and white, but with no legend upon it. He pressed back against a house to give them room to pass. They didn't pass, however, but instead hauled up before a house on the opposite side of the street and stood there, shouting slogans in English and German. He caught the shout of "Liberty!" and someone blew a cavalry charge upon a trumpet. And then he caught the shout of "Rush! Rush! Rush!" Good God, it must be the house he was seeking, that of Dr. Rush. The mob seemed good-humoured, he supposed. They did not mean to drag the doctor out for a dose of tar and feathers, this being a notable form of public entertainment, or so he had been told. Cautiously, he approached and tapped a young woman on the shoulder. "I beg your pardon." He had to lean close and shout into her ear to be heard. She whirled and blinked in surprise, then caught sight of his butterfly waistcoat and broke into a broad smile. He smiled back. "I am seeking Dr. Benjamin Rush," he shouted. "Is this his house?"
"Yes, it is."
A young man beside the young woman heard him and turned, his eyebrows shooting up at sight of Grey.
"You have business with Dr. Rush?"
"I have a letter of introduction to the doctor from a Dr. Franklin, a mutual..."
The young man's face broke into a huge grin. Before he could say anything, though, the door of the house opened, and a slender, well-dressed man in his 30s came out onto the stoop. There was a roar from the crowd, and the man, who must surely be Dr. Rush himself, held out his hands to them, laughing. The noise quieted for a moment, the man leaning out to talk with someone in the crowd. Then he ducked into the house, came out again with his coat on, came down the steps to a roar of applause, and the whole mob moved off again, banging and bugling with renewed fervour.
"Come along," the young man bellowed in his ear. "There'll be free beer."
Which is how Lord John Grey found himself in the tap room of a prosperous tavern, celebrating the first anniversary of the publication of the Declaration of Independence. There were political speeches of an impassioned, if not very eloquent, variety, and it was in the course of these that Grey learned that Dr. Rush was not only a wealthy and influential rebel sympathiser, but a prominent rebel himself. In fact, as he learned from his newfound friends, both Rush and Dr. Franklin turned out to have signed the seditious document in the first place. Word spread through the people round them that Grey was a friend of Franklin's, and he was much hailed in consequence. Eventually, being conveyed by insensible degrees through the crowd until he found himself face to face with Benjamin Rush. It wasn't the first time Grey had been in close proximity to a criminal, and he kept his composure. This was plainly not the time to lay his nephew's situation before Rush, and Grey contented himself with shaking the young doctor by the hand and mentioning his connection with Franklin. Rush was most cordial, and shouted over the noise that Grey must come to call at his house when they both should be at leisure, perhaps in the morning. Gray expressed his great willingness to do so, and retired gracefully through the crowd, hoping that the Crown would not manage to hang Rush before he had a chance to examine Henry. A racket in the street outside put a momentary stop to the festivities. There was considerable shouting and the thump of projectiles striking the front of the building. One of these, which proved to be a large muddy rock, struck and shattered a pane of the establishment's window, allowing the bellows of "Traitors! Renegados!" to be heard more clearly.
"Shut your face, lickspittle!"
someone shouted inside the tavern. Globs of mud and more rocks were hurled, some of these coming through the open door and broken window, along with patriotic shouts of "God save the king!"
"Geld the royal brute!"
shouted Grey's earlier acquaintance in reply, and half the tavern rushed out into the street, some pausing to break legs from stools to assist in the political discussion which then ensued. Grey was somewhat concerned lest Rush be set upon by loyalists in the street and attacked before he could be of use to Henry. But Rush, and a few others, whom he took to be prominent rebels as well, hung back from the fray, and after taking brief counsel, elected to leave through the tavern's kitchen. Grey found himself left in the company of a man from Norfolk named Payne, a malnourished, ill-dressed wretch, large of nose, and vivid of personality, possessed of strong opinions on the subjects of liberty and democracy, and a most remarkable command of epithet regarding the king. Finding conversation difficult, as he could not reasonably express any of his own contrary opinions on these subjects, Grey excused himself with the intention of following Rush and his friends out the back way. The riot outside, having reached a brief crescendo, had proceeded to its natural conclusion with the flight of the loyalists, and people now had begun to flow back into the tavern, borne on a tide of righteous indignation and self-congratulation. Among these was a tall, slender, dark man who looked round from his conversation, met Grey's eye, and stopped dead. Grey walked up to him, hoping that the beating of his heart was not audible above the fading noise in the street.
"Mr. Beauchamp," he said,
and took Perseverance Wainwright by hand and wrist in what might be taken for cordial greeting, but was in reality firm detention.
"A private word with you, sir."
He would not bring Percy to the house he had taken for himself and Dotty. Dotty wouldn't recognize him, for she hadn't even been born when Percy vanished from Grey's life. It was merely the operation of the instinct which would have prevented him giving a small child a venomous snake to play with. Percy, whatever his motive, didn't suggest taking Grey to his lodgings. Probably didn't want Grey knowing where he was staying, in case he thought to abscond quietly. After a moment's indecision, for Grey did not yet know the city, Grey agreed to Percy's suggestion that they walk to the common called Southeast Square.
"It's a potter's field," Percy said, leading the way, "where they bury strangers to the city."
"How appropriate," Grey said.
But Percy either didn't hear or affected not to. It was some way, and they didn't talk much, the streets being full of people. Despite the holiday aspects and the striped banners hung here and there, they all seemed to have a field of stars, though he hadn't seen the same arrangement twice, and the stripes varied in size and colour, some having red, white and blue stripes, some only red and white. There was a frenetic air to the gaiety, and an edged sense of danger in the streets. Philadelphia might be the rebels' capital, but it was far from being a stronghold. The common was quieter, as might be expected of a graveyard. At that, it was surprisingly pleasant. There were only a few wooden grave markers here and there, giving such details as were known about the person interred beneath them. No one would have gone to the expense of placing gravestones, though some charitable soul had erected a large stone cross upon a plinth in the centre of the field. Without conference, they headed for this object, following the course of a small creek that ran through the common. It had occurred to Gray that Percy might have suggested their destination in order to give himself time to think on the way. Well enough, he'd been thinking too. So when Percy sat down upon the base of the plinth and turned to him with an air of expectation, he didn't bother with observations on the weather.
"Tell me about the Baron Ormondine's second sister," he said, standing before Percy.
Percy blinked, startled, but then smiled.
"Really, John, you amaze me. Claude didn't tell you about Amélie, I'm sure."
Gray didn't reply to that, but folded his hands beneath the tail of his coat and waited. Percy thought for a moment, then shrugged.
"All right. She was Claude's older sister. My wife Cécile is the younger."
"Was," Gray repeated.
"So she's dead? She's been dead for some 40 years. Why are you interested in her?"
Percy pulled a handkerchief from his sleeve to dab at his temples. The day was hot, and it had been a long walk. Gray's own shirt was damp.
"Where did she die?" "In a brothel in Paris."
That stopped Gray in his tracks. Percy saw it and gave a wry smile.
"If you must know, John, I'm looking for her son."
Gray stared at him for a moment, then slowly sat down beside him. The grey stone of the plinth was warm under his buttocks.
"All right," he said, after a moment. "Tell me, if you would be so good."
Percy gave him a sideways glance of amusement, full of wariness, but still amused.
"There are things I cannot tell you, John, as you must surely appreciate. By the way, I hear that there is a rather heated discussion taking place between the British Secretaries of State as to which of them shall make an approach regarding my previous offer, and to whom exactly to make it. I suppose this is your doing. I thank you."
"Don't change the subject. I'm not asking you about your previous offer."
"Not yet, anyway.
I'm asking you about Amélie Beauchamp and her son. I cannot see how they may be connected with the other matter, so I assume they have some personal significance to you."
"Naturally, there are things you cannot tell me regarding the larger matter."
He bowed slightly.
"But this mystery about the Baron's sister seems somewhat more personal." "It is."
Percy was turning something over in his mind. Gray could see it working behind his eyes. The eyes were lined and a little pouched, but the same as ever, a warm, lively brown, the colour of sherry sack. His fingers drummed briefly on the stone, then stopped, and he turned to Gray with an air of decision.
"Very well, bulldog that you are. If I don't tell you, you will doubtless be following me all over Philadelphia in an effort to discover my purpose in being here."
This was precisely what Gray intended doing in any case, but he made an indeterminate noise that might be taken as encouragement before asking,
"What is your purpose in being here?" "I'm looking for a printer named Fergus Fraser."
Gray blinked at that. He hadn't been expecting any concrete answer. "Who is..." Percy held up a hand, folding down the fingers as he spoke.
"He is, first, the son of one James Fraser, a notable ex-Jacobite and current rebel. He is, secondly, a printer, as indicated, and, I suspect, a rebel like his father. And thirdly, I strongly suspect that he is the son of Amélie Beauchamp."
There were blue and red dragonflies hovering over the creek. Gray felt as though one of these insects had flown suddenly up his nose.
"You're telling me that James Fraser had an illegitimate son by a French whore, who happened also to be the daughter of an ancient noble family?"
Shock didn't begin to describe his feelings, but he kept his tone light, and Percy laughed.
"No. The printer is Fraser's son, but is adopted. He took the boy from a brothel in Paris more than 30 years ago."
A trickle of sweat ran down the side of Percy's neck, and he wiped it away. The warmth of the day had made his cologne blossom on his skin. Gray caught the hint of ambergris and carnation, spice and musk together.
Emily was, as I said, Claude's older sister. In her teens, she was seduced by a much older man, a married nobleman, and got with child. The normal thing would have been for her simply to be married hastily off to a complacent husband. But the nobleman's wife died quite suddenly, and Amélie made a fuss, insisting that since he was now free, he must marry her. He was not so inclined. No, Claude's father was, though. I suppose he thought such a marriage would improve the family fortunes. The Comte was a very wealthy man, and while not political, did have a certain standing. The old Baron Ormandine had been willing to keep things quiet in the beginning, but as he began to see the possibilities of the situation, he became bolder and threatened all kinds of things, from a complaint to the king, for old Ormandine was active at court, unlike his son, to a lawsuit for damages and an application to the church for excommunication. Could he actually have done that? Grey asked, fascinated, despite his reservations about Percy's veracity. Percy smiled briefly. He could have complained to the king. In any case, he didn't get the chance. Amélie vanished.
The girl had vanished from her home in the middle of one night, taking her jewels. It was thought that perhaps she had intended to run away to her lover in the hope that he would give in and marry her. But the Comte professed complete ignorance of the matter, and no one came forward to say that they had seen her, either leaving Trois Flèches or entering the Paris mansion of the Comte Saint-Germain.
"And you think she somehow ended in a Paris brothel?"
Grey said incredulously.
"How? And if so, how did you discover this?"
"I found her marriage lines."
"What?"
"A contract of marriage between Amélie Élise Levine Beauchamp and Robert François Quenet de Saint-Germain, signed by both parties, and a priest. It was in the library at Trois Flèches, inside the family Bible. Claude and Cécile are not very religiously inclined, I'm afraid,"
Percy said, shaking his head.
"And you are."
That made Percy laugh. He knew that Grey knew precisely what his feelings regarding religion were.
"I was bored," he said, without apology. "Life at Trois Flèches must have been tedious indeed if it forced you to read the Bible."
"Did the sub-gardener quit?"
"Did... Oh, Emile,"
Percy grinned.
"No, but he had a terrible bout of la grippe that month. Couldn't breathe through his nose at all, poor man."
Grey felt again a treacherous impulse to laugh, but restrained it, and Percy went on without a pause.
"I actually wasn't reading it. I have all of the most excessive damnations memorized, after all. I was interested in the cover."
"Heavily bejeweled, was it?"
Grey asked dryly, and Percy gave him a look of mild offence.
"It has not always got to do with money, John. Even for those of us not blessed with such substance as yourself."
"My apologies," said Grey.
"Why the Bible, then?" "I will have you know that I am a bookbinder of no mean repute,"
Percy said, preening a little.
"I took it up in Italy as a means of making a living, after you so gallantly saved my life." "Thank you for that, by the way," he said,
with a direct look whose sudden seriousness made Grey look down to avoid his eyes.
"You're welcome," he said gruffly,
and, bending, carefully induced a small green caterpillar that was inching its way across the polished toe of his boot to inch onto his finger.
"Anyway," Percy went on, not losing a beat, "I discovered this curious document. I had heard of the family scandal, of course, and recognized the names at once."
"You asked the present Baron about it?"
"I did. What did you think of Claude, by the way?"
Percy had always been like Quicksilver, Grey thought, and he hadn't lost any of his mutability with age.
"Bad card player.
A wonderful voice, though. Does he sing?"
"Indeed he does."
"And you're right about the cards. He can keep a secret if he likes, but he can't lie at all. You'd be amazed at how powerful a thing perfect honesty is, in some circumstances,
Percy added reflectively.
It almost makes me think there might be something in the 8th commandment.
Grey muttered something about more honoured in the breach, but then coughed and begged that Percy might continue.
He didn't know about the marriage contract, I'm sure of it. He was genuinely staggered. And after a certain amount of hesitation, bloody, bold, and resolute may be your watchwords, John, but they are not his. He gave his consent for me to dig into the matter.
Grey ignored the implied flattery, if that's what it was, and he thought it was, and carefully deposited the caterpillar onto the leaves of what looked like an edible bush.
You looked for the priest, he said with certainty.
Percy laughed with what sounded like genuine pleasure, and it occurred to Grey with a small shock that, of course, he knew Percy's mind, and Percy his. They had been conversing through the veils of statecraft and secrecy for many years. Of course, Percy had likely known to whom he was talking, and Grey hadn't.
Yes, I did. He was dead, murdered, killed in the street at night while hurrying to give the last rites to a dying parishioner. Such a terrible thing. A week after the disappearance of Amélie Beauchamp.
This was beginning to rouse Grey's professional interest, though the private side of him was still more than wary.
The next thing would have been the Comte. But if he was capable of killing a priest to keep his secrets, it would have been dangerous to approach him directly, Grey said. His servants, then.
Percy nodded, mouth quirked at one corner in appreciation of Grey's acuity.
The Comte was dead, too. Or he disappeared, at least. He had a reputation as a sorcerer, oddly enough, and he died a good 10 years after Amélie. But I looked for his old servants, yes, I found a few of them. For some people, it really is always about money, and the assistant coachman was one of those. 2 days after Amélie disappeared, he delivered a carpet to a brothel near the Rue Faubourg. A very heavy carpet that had about it a smell of opium, which he recognized because he had at one point transported a troop of Chinese acrobats who came to entertain at a fete at the mansion. And so you went to the brothel, where money...
They say water is the universal solvent, Percy said, shaking his head. But it isn't. You could plunge a man into a barrel of freezing water and leave him for a week, and you would accomplish much less than you might with a modest quantity of gold.
Grey silently noted the adjective freezing and nodded to Percy to continue.
It took some time. Repeated visits, different attempts. The madam was a true professional, meaning that whoever had paid her predecessor had done so on a staggering scale, and her doorkeeper, while old enough, had had his tongue torn out at an early age. No help there. And, of course, none of the whores had been there when the infamous carpet was delivered, that being so long before.
He had, however, patiently traced the families of the present whores, for some occupations run in families, and managed, after months of work, to discover an old woman who had been employed at the brothel and who recognised the miniature of Amélie that he had brought from Trois Flèches. The girl had indeed been brought to the brothel in the middle stages of pregnancy. That hadn't mattered particularly. There were patrons with such tastes. A few months later, she had been delivered of a son. She had survived childbirth, but died a year later, during a plague of influenza.
And I could not begin to tell you the difficulties of finding out anything about a child born in a Paris brothel 40-odd years ago, my dear.
Percy sighed, employing his handkerchief again.
But your name is Perseverance,
Grey noted with extreme dryness. And Percy glanced sharply at him.
Do you know? He said lightly. I believe you are the only person in the world who knows that.
and from the expression in his eyes, that was one too many.
"Your secret is safe with me," Gray said. "That one, at least." "What about Dennis Randall Isaacs?"
It worked. Percy's face shimmered like a pool of quicksilver in the sun. In half a heartbeat, he had the perfect blankness back in place. But it was too late. Gray laughed, though without humour, and stood up.
"Thank you, Perseverance," he said,
and walked away through the grassy graves of the nameless poor. That night, when his household was asleep, he took pen and ink to write to Arthur Norrington, to Harry Quarry, and to his brother. Toward dawn, he began, for the first time in 2 years, to write to Jamie Fraser. Chapter 59. Battle of Bennington, September the 11th, 1777, General Burgoyne's Camp. The smoke of burnt and burning fields hung over the camp, had done so for days. The Americans were still withdrawing, destroying the countryside in their wake. William was with Sandy Lindsay, talking about the best way to cook a turkey, one of Lindsay's scouts having just brought him one, when the letter arrived. It was likely William's imagination that a dreadful silence fell upon the camp, the earth shook, and the veil of the temple was rent in twain. But it was very shortly apparent that something had happened, nonetheless. There was a definite change in the air, something amiss in the rhythms of speech and movement among the men surrounding them. Balcarres felt it too, and stopped in his examination of the turkey's outspread wing, looking at William with eyebrows raised.
"What?" said William. "I don't know, but it isn't good."
Balcarres thrust the limp turkey into his orderly's hands and, snatching up his hat, made for Burgoyne's tent, William on his heels. They found Burgoyne tight-lipped and white with anger, his senior officers in clusters round him, speaking to one another in low, shocked voices. Captain Sir Francis Clark, the general's aide-de-camp, emerged from the press, head down and face shadowed. Balcarres caught at his elbow as he passed.
"Francis? What's happened?"
Captain Clark was looking noticeably agitated. He glanced behind him into the tent, then stepped aside and moved out of earshot, taking Balcarres and William with him.
"How?" he said. "He's not coming."
"Not coming?" William said stupidly. "But is he not leaving New York after all?"
"He's leaving," Clark said, his lips so tight it was a wonder he could speak at all. "To invade Pennsylvania."
"But..."
Balcarres darted an appalled look toward the entrance to the tent, then back at Clark.
"Exactly."
The true proportions of the disaster were revealing themselves to William. General Howe was not merely cocking a snook at General Burgoyne by ignoring his plan, which would be bad enough from Burgoyne's point of view. By choosing to march on Philadelphia rather than coming up the Hudson to join Burgoyne's troops, Howe had left Burgoyne essentially to his own devices, in terms of supply and reinforcement. In other words, they were on their own, separated from their supply trains, with the disagreeable choice of continuing to pursue the retreating Americans through a wilderness from which all sustenance had been stripped, or turning round and marching ignominiously back to Canada through a wilderness from which all sustenance had been stripped. Balcarres had been expostulating along these lines to Sir Francis, who rubbed a hand over his face in frustration, shaking his head.
"I know," he said, "if you'll excuse me, my lords."
"Where are you going?" William asked,
and Clark glanced at him.
"To tell Mrs. Lynde," Clark said. "I thought I'd best warn her."
Mrs. Lynde was the wife of the chief commissary officer. She was also General Burgoyne's mistress. Whether Mrs. Lynde had exerted her undeniable gifts to good effect, or whether the general's natural resiliency of character had asserted itself, the blow of Howe's letter was swiftly encompassed.
"Whatever you want to say about him," William wrote in his weekly letter to Lord John,
He knows the benefit of certain decision and swift action. We have resumed our pursuit of the Americans' chief body of troops with redoubled effort. Most of our horses have been abandoned, stolen, or eaten. I have quite worn through the soles of one pair of boots. In the meantime, we receive intelligence from one of the scouts to the effect that the town of Bennington, which is not too far distant, is being used as a gathering place for the American commissary. By report, it is lightly guarded, and so the general is sending Colonel Baum, one of the Hessians, with 500 troops to capture these much-needed supplies. We leave in the morning. Whether his drunken conversation with Balcarres was in part responsible, William never knew, but he had discovered that he was now spoken of as being good with Indians. And whether it was owing to this dubious capacity, or to the fact that he could speak basic German, he found himself on the morning of August the 12th deputed to accompany Colonel Baum's foraging expedition, this including a number of dismounted Brunswick cavalry, 2 3-pounder artillery pieces, and 100 Indians. By report, the Americans were receiving cattle funneled out of New England, these being collected in quantity in Bennington, as well as a considerable number of wagons, these full of corn, flour, and other necessaries. It was, for a wonder, not raining when they set out, and that alone gave the expedition a feeling of optimism. Anticipation of food increased this sense significantly. Rations had been short for what seemed a very long time, though in fact it had been only a week or so. Still, more than a day spent marching without adequate food seems a long time, as William had good cause to know. Many of the Indians were still mounted. They circled the main body of soldiers, riding ahead a little way to scout the road, coming back to offer guidance through or around places where the road, no more than a trace at the best of times, had given up the fight and had been absorbed by the forest or drowned by one of the rain-swollen streams that leapt unexpectedly out of the hills. Bennington was near a river called the Wollumsack, and as they walked, William was discussing, in a desultory way with one of the Hessian lieutenants, whether it might be possible to load the stores onto rafts for transport to a rendezvous downstream. This discussion was entirely theoretical, since neither of them knew where the Wollumsack went, nor whether it was navigable to any extent, but it gave both men a chance to practice the other's language, and so pass the time on a long, hot march. "My father spent much time in Germany," William told Oberleutnant Grunwald in his careful, slow German. "He is of the food of Hanover very fond." Grunwald, from Hesse Kassel, allowed himself a derisive twitch of the moustache at mention of Hanover, but contented himself with the observation that even a Hanoverian could roast a cow and perhaps boil some potatoes to accompany it. "But his own mother made a dish from the flesh of swine and apples, beswimming in red wine and spiced with nutmeg and cinnamon, that made his mouth water only to remember." Water was running down Grunwald's face, sweat making tracks in the dust and dampening the collar of his light blue coat. He took off his tall grenadier's headdress and wiped his head with a giant spotted kerchief, sodden from many earlier employments. "I think we will maybe not find cinnamon today," Willie said. "Maybe a pig, though."
"If we do, I will him roast for you," Grunwald assured him. "As for apples..."
He tucked a hand into his tunic and withdrew a handful of small red crab apples, which he shared out with William.
"I have a bushel of these. I have..."
Excited yips from an Indian riding back down the column interrupted him, and William looked up to see the rider throw back an arm, gesturing behind him and shouting, "River!" The world enlivened the sagging columns, and William saw the cavalry, who had insisted upon wearing their high boots and their broadswords in spite of their lack of horses, and had suffered in consequence, draw themselves up, clanking loudly with anticipation.
Another shout came from the forward line.
Cowtards!
That caused a general cheer and much laughter among the men, who hastened on with a quicker step. William saw Colonel Baum, who did still have a horse, turn out of the column and wait on the roadside, leaning down to speak briefly with the officers as they came past. William saw his aide lean close, pointing up a small hill opposite.
"What do you think?" he said, turning to Grunwald,
and was startled to find the Oberleutnant staring at him blank-faced, his jaw hanging open. The man's hand loosened and fell to his side, and the mitred helmet fell and rolled away in the dust. William blinked and saw a thick worm of red snake its way slowly down from under Grunwald's dark hair. Grunwald sat down quite suddenly and fell backward in the road, his face gone a muddy white.
"Shit," said William,
and jerked suddenly to an awareness of what had just happened.
"Ambush!" he shouted at the top of his lungs. "Das ist eine Überfall!"
There were shouts of alarm rising from the column and the crack of sporadic firing from the woods. William grabbed Grunwald under the arms and dragged him hastily into the shelter of a group of pine trees. The Oberleutnant was still alive, though his coat was wet with sweat and blood. William made sure the German's pistol was loaded and in his hand before taking his own pistol and dashing towards Baum, who was standing in his stirrups, shrieking directions in high, shrill German. He caught only a word here and there, and looked urgently round to see whether he could tell what the colonel's orders were from the actions of the Hessians. He caught sight of a little group of scouts running down the road toward him, and ran to meet them.
"Goddamn lot of rebels!"
one scout gasped out of breath, pointing behind him.
"Coming!"
"Where?"
"How far?"
He felt as though he were about to run out of his skin, but forced himself to stand still, speak calmly, breathe.
"A mile, maybe two."
He did breathe then, and managed to ask how many there were.
"Maybe 200, maybe more.
Armed with muskets, but no artillery."
"Right. Go back and keep an eye on them."
He turned back toward Colonel Baum, feeling the surface of the road strange under his feet, as though it wasn't quite where he expected it to be. They dug in, hastily but efficiently, entrenching themselves behind shallow earthworks and makeshift barricades of fallen trees. The guns were dragged up the small hill and aimed to cover the road. The rebels, of course, ignored the road and swarmed in from both sides. There might have been 200 in the first wave. It was impossible to count them as they darted through the heavy wood. William could see the flicker of movement and fired at it, but without any great hope of hitting anyone. The wave hesitated, but only for a moment. Then a strong voice bellowed somewhere behind the rebel front.
"We take them now, or Molly Stark's a widow tonight."
"What?" said William, disbelieving. Whatever the man shouting had meant, his exhortation had a marked effect, for an enormous number of rebels came boiling out of the trees, headed at a mad run for the guns. The soldiers, minding the guns, promptly fled, and so did a good many of the others. The rebels were making short work of the rest, and William had just settled down grimly to do what he could before they got him, when two Indians came springing over the rolling ground, seized him under the arms, and yanking him to his feet, propelled him rapidly away. Which was how Lieutenant Lord Ellesmere found himself once more cast in the role of Cassandra, reporting the debacle at Bennington to General Burgoyne. Men killed and wounded, guns lost, and not a single cow to be shown for it.
"And I haven't yet killed a single rebel either," he thought tiredly, making his way slowly back to his tent afterward.
He thought he should regret that, but wasn't sure he did. Chapter 60 Deserter Game, Round 2 Jamie had been bathing in the river, sluicing sweat and grime from his body, when he heard remarkably odd swearing in French.
The words were French, but the sentiments expressed were definitely not.
Curious, he clambered out of the water, dressed, and went down the bank a little way, where he discovered a young man waving his arms and gesturing in an agitated attempt to make himself understood to a bemused party of workmen. As half of them were Germans, and the rest Americans from Virginia, his efforts to communicate with them in French had so far succeeded only in entertaining them. Jamie had introduced himself and offered his services as interpreter, which is how he came to spend a good bit of each day with the young Polish engineer, whose unpronounceable last name had quickly been shortened to Kos. He found Kos both intelligent and rather touching in his enthusiasm, and was himself interested in the fortifications Kosciuszko, for he prided himself on being able to say it correctly, was building. Kos, for his part, was both grateful for the linguistic assistance and interested in the occasional observations and suggestions that Jamie was able to make as the result of his conversations with Brianna. Talking about vectors and stresses made him miss her almost unbearably, but at the same time brought her somehow nearer to him, and he found himself spending more and more time with the young Pole, learning bits of his language, and allowing Kos to practice what he fondly imagined to be English.
"What is it that brought you here?"
Jamie asked one day. In spite of the lack of pay, a remarkable number of European officers had come to join, or tried to join, the Continental Army, evidently feeling that even if the prospects of plunder were limited, they could bamboozle the Congress into granting them rank as generals, which they could then parlay into further occupation back in Europe. Some of these dubious volunteers were actually of use, but he'd heard a good bit of muttering about those who weren't. Thinking of Matthias Fermois, he was inclined to mutter a bit himself. Kos wasn't one of these, though.
"Well, first money,"
he said frankly when asked how he had come to be in America.
"My brother the manor in Poland has, but family no money, nothing for me. No girl look at me without money."
He shrugged.
"No place in Polish army. But I know how to build things. I come where things to build."
He grinned.
"Maybe girls, too. Girls with good family, good money." "If you came for money and girls, man, you joined the wrong army,"
Jamie said dryly, and Kosciuszko laughed.
"I say first money," he corrected. "I come to Philadelphia and read there La Déclaration."
He pronounced it in French, and bared his head in reverence at the name, clasping his sweat-stained hat to his breast.
"This thing, this writing, I am ravish."
So ravished was he by the sentiments expressed in that noble document that he had at once sought out its author. While probably surprised by the sudden advent of a passionate young Pole in his midst, Thomas Jefferson had made him welcome, and the two men had spent most of a day deeply involved in the discussion of philosophy, in French, from which they had emerged fast friends.
"Great man," Kos assured Jamie solemnly, crossing himself before putting his hat back on. "God keep him safe." "Dieu accorde lui la sagesse,"
Jamie replied.
"God grant him wisdom."
He thought that Jefferson would certainly be safe, as he was no soldier, which reminded him uncomfortably of Benedict Arnold, but that wasn't a matter he could or would do anything about. Kos had wiped a strand of stringy dark hair out of his mouth and shaken his head.
"Maybe, wife, one day, if God wills. This, what we do here, more important than wife."
They returned to work, but Jamie found his mind dwelling with interest on the conversation. The notion that it was better to spend one's life in pursuit of a noble goal than merely to seek safety, he agreed with that entirely. But surely, such purity of purpose was the province of men without families. A paradox there. A man who sought his own safety was a coward. A man who risked his family's safety was a poltroon, if not worse. That led on to more rambling paths of thought and further interesting paradoxes.
Do women hold back the evolution of such things as freedom and other social ideals out of fear for themselves or their children? Or do they, in fact, inspire such things and the risks required to teach them by providing the things worth fighting for? Not merely fighting to defend, either, but to propel forward. For a man wanted more for his children than he would ever have. He would have to ask Claire what she thought of this, though he smiled to think of some of the things she might think of it, particularly the part about whether women hindered social evolution by their nature. She told him something of her own experiences in the Great War. He couldn't think of it by any other name, though she told him there was another, earlier one by that name. She said disparaging things about heroes now and then, but only when he'd hurt himself. She knew fine what men were for. Would he be here, in fact, if it weren't for her? Would he do this anyway, only for the sake of the ideals of the revolution, if he were not assured of victory? He had to admit that only a madman, an idealist, or a truly desperate man would be here now. Any sane person who knew anything about armies would have shaken his head and turned away, appalled. He often felt appalled himself. But he would, in fact, do it, were he alone. A man's life had to have more purpose than only to feed himself each day. And this was a grand purpose, grander maybe than anyone else fighting for it knew. And if it took his own life in the doing, he wouldn't enjoy it, but he'd be comforted in the dying, knowing he'd helped. After all, it wasn't as though he would be leaving his wife helpless. Unlike most wives, Claire would have a place to go if something befell him. He was once more in the river, floating on his back and thinking along these lines, when he heard a gasp. It was a feminine gasp, and he put his feet down at once and stood up, wet hair streaming over his face. He shoved it back to find Rachel Hunter standing on the bank, both hands pressed over her eyes, and every line of her body strained in an eloquence of distress. "Did you want me, Rachel?" he asked, wiping water out of his eyes in an effort to locate just where on the riverbank he had left his clothes. She gasped again and turned her face in his direction, hands still over her eyes. "Friend James, my wife said I would find thee here. I beg pardon for... Please, come out at once!" Her anguish broke out and her hands dropped, though she kept her eyes tight shut as she reached out to him, pleading.
"What?"
"Denny. The British have him." Cold shot through his veins, much colder than the wind on his exposed wet skin.
"Where? How? You can look now,"
he added, hastily buttoning his breeches. "He went with another man, posing as deserters." He was up the bank beside her, shirt over his arm, and saw that she had her brother's spectacles in the pocket of her apron. Her hand kept going to them, clutching them. "I told him not to, I did."
"I told him too," Jamie said grimly. "Are you sure, lass?"
She nodded, pale as a sheet, and her eyes huge in her face, but not yet, weeping. "The other man, he came back just now and ran to find me. It was ill luck," he said. "They were brought before a major, and it was the same man who had threatened to hang Denny when he did it last time. The other man ran for it and escaped. But they caught Denny, and this time... She was gasping for breath and could barely speak for dread, he saw. He put a hand on her arm.
"Find the other man and send him to my tent so he can tell me exactly where your brother is. I'll go to fetch Ian, and we'll get him back."
He squeezed her arm gently to make her look at him, and she did, though so distracted, he thought, she barely saw him.
"Dinna fash yourself. We'll get him back for you," he repeated gently. "I swear it, by Christ and his mother."
"Thee must not swear." "Oh, the devil with it," she cried, then clapped a hand over her mouth. She shut her eyes, swallowed, and took it away again. "Thank you," she said.
You're welcome, he said,
with an eye to the sinking sun. Did the British prefer to hang people at sunset or at dawn?
We'll get him back, he said once more, firmly.
Dead or alive.
The camp's commanding officer had built a gibbet in the centre of the camp. It was a crude affair of unbarked logs and rough timber, and from the holes and gouges around its nails had been disassembled and moved several times. It looked effective, though, and the dangling noose gave Jamie a feeling of ice in his water.
We've played the deserter game once too often, Jamie whispered to his nephew. Or maybe three.
Do you think he's ever used it?
Ian murmured back, peering down at the sinister thing through their screen of oak saplings.
He wouldn't go to that much work only to scare someone.
It scared him badly. He didn't point out to Ian the spot near the bottom of the main upright, where someone's, or someone's, desperate flailing feet had kicked away chunks of the bark. The makeshift gibbet wasn't high enough for the drop to break a man's neck. A man hanged on it would strangle slowly. He touched his own neck in reflexive aversion. Roger Mack's mangled throat and its ugly, raw scar clear in his mind. Even clearer was the memory of the grief that had overwhelmed him coming to take down Roger Mack from the tree they'd hanged him on, knowing him dead and the world changed forever. It had been, too, though he hadn't died.
Well, it wasn't going to change for Rachel Hunter. They weren't too late, that was the important thing.
He said as much to Ian, who didn't reply but gave him a brief glance of surprise.
How do you know it? It said, plain as words.
He lifted a shoulder and inclined his head toward a spot a little farther down the hill, where an outcrop of rock covered in moss and bearberry would give them cover. They moved off silently, keeping low, making their movements in the same slow rhythm to which the wood was moving. It was twilight, and the world was full of shadows. It was no trick to be two more. He knew they hadn't hanged Denny Hunter yet, because he'd seen men hanged. Execution left a stain upon the air and marked the souls of those who saw it. The camp was quiet. Not literally, the soldiers were making considerable racket, and a good thing too, but in terms of its spirit. There was neither a sense of dread oppression nor the sick excitement that sprang from the same source. You could feel such things. So Denny Hunter was either here alive or had been sent elsewhere. If he was here, where would he be?
Confined somehow and under guard.
This wasn't a permanent camp. There was no stockade. It was a big camp, though, and it took them some time to circle it, checking to see whether Hunter might be somewhere in the open, tied to a tree or shackled to a wagon. He was nowhere in sight, though. That left the tents. There were four large ones, and one of these plainly housed the commissary. It stood apart and had a small cluster of wagons near it. It had also a constant stream of men going in and out, emerging with sacks of flour or dried peas. No meat, though he could smell cooking rabbit and squirrel from some of the campfires. The German deserters had been right then. The army was living off the land as well as it could.
The commander's tent, Ian whispered softly to him.
It was plain to see with its pennants and the knot of men who stood about just outside its entrance.
I hope not.
Plainly they'd have taken Denny Hunter to the commander for interrogation. And if he was still in doubt as to Hunter's bona fides, he might have kept the man close at hand for further questioning. Had he already made up his mind on the matter, though, and Rachel had been convinced of it, he wouldn't keep him. He would have been sent somewhere under guard to await his reckoning. Under guard and out of sight, though Jamie doubted the British commander feared a rescue attempt.
Ini, mini, mini, mo,
he muttered under his breath, twitching a finger back and forth between the two remaining tents. A guard with a musket was standing more or less between them.
No telling which he was set to guard.
That one.
He lifted his chin to the one on the right, but even as he did so, felt Ian stiffen beside him.
Nay, Ian said softly, eyes riveted. The other.
There was something strange in Ian's voice, and Jamie glanced at him in surprise, then down at the tent.
At first, his only thought was a fleeting sense of confusion.
Then the world changed. It was twilight, but they were by now no more than 50 yards away. There was no mistaking it. He hadn't seen the boy since he was 12, but he had memorized every moment they'd spent in each other's presence. The way he carried himself. The quick, graceful movement.
That's from his mother,
he thought in a daze of shock, seeing the tall young officer make a gesture of the hand that was Geneva Dunsany to the life. The shape of his back, his head and ears, though the slender shoulders had thickened to a man's.
Mine, he thought,
with a surge of pride that shocked him nearly as much as William's sudden appearance had.
They're mine.
Jarring as they were, these thoughts took less than half a second to dash through his head and out again. He breathed in, very slowly, and out again. Had Ian remembered William from their meeting 7 years earlier? Or was the resemblance so instantly visible to a casual eye? It didn't matter now. The camp was beginning its supper preparations. Within minutes, everyone would be engrossed in the meal. It was better to move then, even without the cover of darkness.
It has to be me, aye?
Ian gripped his wrist, compelling his attention.
Do you want to make the diversion before or after?
After.
He'd been thinking in the back of his mind all the time they were creeping toward the camp, and now the decision lay ready, as though someone else had made it.
Best if we can get him away quiet. Try, and if things go wrong, screech.
Ian nodded, and with no further conversation dropped to his belly and began a stealthy worming through the brush. The evening was cool and pleasant after the heat of the day, but Jamie's hands felt cold, and he cupped them round the clay belly of the little firepot. He'd carried it from their own camp, feeding it bits of dry stick along the way. It was hissing softly to itself as it fed on a chunk of dried hickory, both the sight and the smell of it safely hidden in the haze of campfire smoke that drifted through the trees, dispelling the gnats and the bloodthirsty mosquitoes, thank God and his mother. Wondering at his own twitching, it wasn't like him. He touched his sporran, checking yet again that the cork hadn't come loose from the bottle of turpentine, even though he knew well it hadn't.
He'd smell it.
The arrows in his quiver shifted as he shifted his weight, the fletchings rustling. He was in easy bowshot of the commander's tent, and could have the canvas well alight in seconds if Ian screeched.
If he didn't.
He began to move again, eyes flitting over the ground, searching for a patch that would do. Dry grass there was in plenty, but it would go up too fast if that was all there was. He wanted a fast flame, but a big one. The soldiers would have already scavenged the nearby forest for firewood, but he spotted a fallen fir snag, too heavy to carry away. Foragers had snapped the lower branches off, but there were plenty left, thick with dried needles that the wind hadn't taken. He moved back slowly, far enough out of sight that he could move quickly again, gathering armfuls of dry grass, bark scraped hastily from a log, anything that would kindle. Flaming arrows in the commander's tent would compel instant attention, to be sure, but they would also cause widespread alarm. Soldiers would boil out of the camp like hornets looking for attackers. A grass fire? No. Such things were common. And while it would certainly create diversion, no one would be looking further once they had seen it was nothing. A few minutes and he had his diversion ready. So busy he'd been, he hadn't even taken thought to look again at his son.
God damn you for a liar, Jamie Fraser,
he said under his breath, and looked. William
was gone. The soldiers were at their supper. Cheerful talk and the sounds of eating covered any small noises that Ian made as he walked softly round the side of the left-hand tent. If someone saw him, he'd speak to them in Mohawk, claim to be a scout from Burgoyne's camp, come with information. By the time they got him in front of the commander, he'd either have thought of some good picturesque information, or he'd scream and reckon to fight his way out while they were distracted by flaming arrows. That wouldn't help Denny Hunter, though, and he was careful. There were pickets posted, but he and Uncle Jamie had watched long enough to see the pattern of them and spy the dead spot where a picket's vision was obstructed by the trees. He knew he couldn't be seen behind the tent, save someone heading for the woods for a piss stumbled over him. There was a gap at the bottom of the tent, and a candlestick lit inside. A spot in the canvas glowed dim in the twilight. He watched the gap and saw no shadow move. Right then. He lay down and inserted a cautious hand, feeling along the dirt floor, hoping no one inside stamped on his hand. If he could find a cot, he could squirm in and lie under it. If... Something touched his hand and he bit his tongue hard. "Is thee a friend?" whispered Denny's voice. Ian could see the Quaker's shadow on the canvas, a squatting blur, and Denny's hand held his hard.
"Aye, it's me," he whispered back. "Keep quiet. Stand back."
Denny moved, and Ian heard the chink of metal.
Damn it, the buggers had him in fetters.
He compressed his lips and slid under the edge of the tent. Denny greeted him silently, his face alight with hope and alarm. The little Quaker lifted his hands, nodded to his feet.
Full irons. Christ, they did mean to hang him.
Ian leaned in close to whisper in Denny's ear.
"I go out before you. Lie down there, easy as you can, close as you can."
He jerked his chin at the back wall of the tent.
"Dinna move yourself. I'll pull you through."
Then get Denny onto his shoulders like a dead fawn and head for the woods, hooting like an owl to let Uncle Jamie know it was time to set the fire. It wasn't possible to move a man in chains in total silence, but with any luck at all, the scraping of spoons on mess kits and the soldiers' conversation would cover any stray clinking. He pulled the canvas out as far as he could, reached under, and took firm hold of Denny's shoulders.
The wee bugger was heavier than he looked,
but Ian got Denny's upper body mostly clear of the tent without too much trouble. Sweating, he scuttled to the side and reached in to take hold of Denny's ankles, wrapping the chain round his own wrist to take up the slack. There was no sound, but Ian's head jerked up before his mind even told him that the air near him had moved in a way that meant someone was standing there.
"Hush," he said by reflex,
not knowing whether he was talking to Denny or to the tall soldier who had stepped out of the wood behind him.
"What the devil?"
the soldier began, sounding startled. He didn't finish the question, but took 3 paces fast and grabbed Ian by the wrist.
"Who are you, and what are you—" "Good God, where did you come from?"
William the soldier stared into Ian's face, and Ian thanked God briefly for the fact that his other wrist was immobilized by Denny's chain, for otherwise William would be already dead, and he didn't want to have to tell Uncle Jamie that.
"He has come to help me escape, friend William,"
Denny Hunter said mildly from the shadows on the ground behind Ian.
"I would take it kindly if thee did not hinder him, though I will understand if thy duty compels thee."
William's head jerked, looked wildly round, then down. Had the circumstances been less dire, Ian would have laughed at the expressions, for there were a great number of them run through in the course of a heartbeat on it. William closed his eyes for an instant, then opened them again.
"Don't tell me," he said. "I don't want to know."
He squatted beside Ian, and between them they had Denny out in a matter of seconds. Ian took a deep breath, put his hands to his mouth, and hooted, then paused a moment, and did it once again. William stared at him in mingled puzzlement and anger. Then Ian ducked the point of his shoulder into Denny's midriff and, with William heaving, got the doctor onto his shoulders with little more than a startled grunt and a slight clanking of fetters.